The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Heidi ho, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his computer-generated friend Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 74 of The Big Picture for the week beginning August 28. And coming up on today's show, we've got Kubo and the Two Strings, one of the most creative animations at the cinemas for a kid near you.
And have you been missing the soul-destroying shenanigans of The Office? Well, David Brent's back with Life on the Road.
And arguably the most moving and Christian film of the year with Free State of Jones.
The most moving Christian film of the year?
Absolutely.
Free State of Jones.
You wait for this review. Seriously, it is really good.
All right, I'm going to wait around for that because that's coming up later in the show. But first, Mark, as we always do, let's do a quick whip around of what else is happening this week at cinemas. Opening last Thursday, Ben-Hur, this much-talked-about remake of the 1959 classic. You reviewed it on the show last week. You can check out Mark's review at thebigpicturewebsite.com. We also did an interview on the show last week, Mark, with Roma Downey, producer of Ben-Hur. Later on this show, I got to speak with none other than Jesus, or the actor who played Jesus, Rodrigo Santoro, and that interview is coming up later on.
He has lovely hair.
He does have lovely hair. That's true. We didn't discuss that. We discussed many other things.
Well, you got to see. Well, actually, we don't have a video version of that, but he does have lovely hair. Google him. The Code, Season 2, Episode 1, begins on the ABC this Thursday, 1st of September at 8:30pm. This is an Outback drama. I don't know if you've actually seen the first season, but look, it was a great series exploring issues surrounding the freedom of speech and national security in a digital age. Well, Season 2 unveils the rapidly spreading and very real threat of cybercrime and its capacity to bring an entire country to its knees. So check it out on the ABC this week.
Speaking of prominent Australian TV series, Clever Man is out on DVD and Blu-ray. I reckon it was one of the most ambitious and internationally competitive shows around, Mark. Clever Man. There was a little bit too much going on, too many threads throughout the show, but overall, I was pretty impressed with it, and it really built to a great cliffhanger for Season 2, the final episode. It's worth watching the series just for the final episode.
Yeah, the series actually was, I like how you say, like, ambitious, because I feel like it really stretched Australian television. I thought it was a great thing. Well, okay, also speaking about Australian television and something it probably won't stretch is a great deal at all, last week Australian Survivor started on Channel 10, airing Mondays at 7:30pm. It's complete with a new tribe of 24 willing young hopefuls keen to build their own shelters, light their own fires, and be deprived of the basic comforts of life.
How many series of Survivor have there been? I mean, it's that Survivor for a long time. Is that loads of people love the Survivor?
We are literally up to 19 million. Season 19.
Count.
But
look,
actually, weirdly, I've always thought that Channel 10 is particularly ambitious doing this on account of the fact that every other network's had a go at Australian Survivor and failed. So good on them for giving it a go. The usual format applies: brave the immunity challenge and win or race or face the tribal council where sudden death, being voted off the show, is imminent. And this series is set on the rugged tropical South Pacific island of Samoa. Oh, it's a hard life.
For some. Also, Mark, we're talking a lot about Australian screen stuff this week. In news this week, the world's largest short film festival, which is TropFest, the Australian Short Film Festival that's been going for 25 years. It's announced that it's moving to a new home. It's been screened in the Domain for almost since time began, apart from when it began in a cafe in Surry Hills. But it's now moving to Parramatta. After huge financial trouble last year, the TropFest has re-emerged from its own ashes, apparently, and it is going to be held at what seems to be the actual heart of Sydney, at least the geographical heart, in Parramatta. From next year, TropFest will be there.
They put it on a bus route for me. I'm much happier with
this. But that's exactly why they decided to do it, yes, for you.
And in more entertainment news, Mark Hadley offers an apology. Yes, it's a rare event, so we thought we'd make it a part of our news. You see, every now and then we get something wrong, and I thought this was an occasion.
What?
I know. Here am I, bearing my soul on air. I thought it was important enough to draw your attention to this. Last show, I made some pretty dire predictions about the release of War Dogs, which opened this past week, and due to the vagaries of preview screenings, I wasn't able to actually see the film until a couple of days ago.
But that's never stopped you from making comment about
a movie,
has it, Mark?
I know, which is why every now and again someone must eat a slice of humble pie. The fact is, the trailers were pitching it very much as a new Jonah Hill comedy, and that put me much in the mind of Superbad and Wolf of Wall Street.
You're not a fan of the actor Jonah Hill?
Oh, well, not in the comedies he normally does.
Not in the comedies.
And I figure that given his track record, I had something to stand on.
Okay, so where's the apology here?
Well, it was basically, I forgot about the fact that he could actually do decent films.
You know, reminded you of that. He was in Moneyball.
That's what I'm trying to say. And I just want to say to people, listen, if you are thinking, if you have been misled by the trailers like me, that you think that War Dogs is just going to be another sort of like crazy comedy with Jonah Hill saying offensive things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you're way off track. War Dogs is much more like Moneyball. It's got incredible, interesting. Okay, it does have a huge amount of suggestive and dialogue and strong language, but the truth is it actually is really quite well worth doing. If I turned you off, then you have my sincere regrets. Apology complete.
Whoa, Mark, all right. On that note, I'm not really sure where to go apart from true or false before we get to what your kids are watching for this week. You mentioned right at the kickoff, one of the most amazing Christian films you've seen all year is Free State of Jones. You're reviewing that later in the show. Matthew McConaughey is the actor in that movie. So for true or false, Matthew McConaughey, he first appeared on the cover of Vanity Fair in 1996, quite a long time ago, and at that time, not many people knew who he was.
Is that the true or false? He does look like a bit of a poster boy.
Wait for it. So he wasn't very well known at the time. So he actually asked his mum to be careful about what information she shared because he was starting to do interviews and getting known. And so, mum, could you be a bit cautious? She said, of course. And then a week later, he was watching a TV tabloid program when he was surprised to see his mum giving the journalist a tour of his old bedroom. True or false?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to come back on that, but families.
Okay. I'll give you the answer once we discuss what your kids are watching this week. Hollywood long ago recognized that children were a market well worth cultivating, didn't they, Mark? And as a result, every holiday break, we see a string of releases aimed squarely at the youngest members of your household, many of which we try and feature in our first segment of the show every week. This one, what your kids are watching. Kubo and the Two Strings is just such a film. Kubo is a unique and complex animation set in ancient Japan about a poor boy who must evade demons and gods in order to save himself and his family. It's got just the sort of childish sidekicks in it you've come to expect. There's a talking monkey, a giant samurai beetle, but it also includes some rather adult thoughts about death, spirits, and eternal life.
My name is Kubo. I look after my mother mostly. What was father like?
He was just like you. Strong and so handsome.
Ugh, mother. I use magic to tell stories.
If you must blink, do it now.
About epic battles, warriors, and monsters. But I had no idea my stories were actually true.
Kubo. We've been looking for you for so long.
Kubo, you must find your father's armor. It's your only chance.
Kubo's a pretty unusual hero. He's a one-eyed boy who lives with his mother on a desolate hillside just outside a village. And straight away you get an idea that there's something not quite right about his life. He's not allowed to go out into the moonlight. Whatever happens, he shouldn't do that.
Don't go out after dark.
I know. His mother is in a sort of a semi-comatose state, except at night, you know, when she comes alive and tells him stories. And he has the amazing ability to play his... I can't remember the name of that instrument. But anyway,
I can't either. Some ancient Japanese instrument, like a guitar.
It'll come to me later. Anyway, and when he plays it, he can then manipulate paper into great origami, you know, feats. And he basically is pursued by these nasty spirits that he somehow awakens across the world until he finds a magical armor which will save him, apparently. Mm. Well, you've got to see that to see it, find out.
What kind of animation's going on here? Because we're not talking about studios like the big ones, Pixar, Disney, DreamWorks, the well-known ones. This is from another animation studio. What sort of style are we looking at?
This is Laika Entertainment. You might remember them from Coraline. Look,
And that was a very dark kids movie.
Yeah, it was too, and so is this. We'll get onto that in a second, but the animation, you'll be wooed by this. Honestly, it's a very clever combination of a whole lot of different styles. So it looks like stop motion animation, you know, just kind of like Wallace and Gromit. And then you start to realize there's much more about it. It's got CGI built in amongst it. And then even vast bigatures. I don't know if you remember Peter Jackson using large scale things to film smaller versions of itself.
What did you call them? Bigatures?
Bigatures.
As in big miniatures.
Yeah, exactly.
I see what they did there with that word.
So using puppets that are maybe like 14 feet tall in order to get a real sort of sense of detail. It's incredible. It's just for watching alone, you'd probably want to see the film.
Yeah. Now, you're saying it looks amazing, but there's also a lot of intense imagery, right? Like not only dark forces and spiritual content, but serious issues like death and disability all show up in Kubo. So Do parents need to prepare themselves for this?
Yes, certainly. This is a case where you've got to be aware you can't just take any child into this screening. Let's start with the easy ones. Disability, there's a wonderful relationship there between Kubo and his mother. His mother is basically almost comatose, catatonic for much of the film, and he has to care for her. And that's kind of a very mature role for a child to see themselves in. But then you've got the spirit world. You've got these elemental spirits and vengeful gods that are out there to get the bad guys. To get the good guys. Very much like Japanese horror, weirdly. There's some of the elements and the picture arrangements in this film that remind me of much more adult films like The Ring and things like that. So that's a bit scary. And then you've got the idea of our interaction with the dead. Shintoism is very strong in this. If you don't know what that is, it's Japanese ancestor worship. And so the idea of praying to our ancestors, of setting little lanterns alight so their spirits can be guided to the next world. This is something that I think parents will realize is scenery, but should still be aware that it's there and should let kids know, you know, what this is all about and how it differs.
Out of all of those things, it sounds like Kubo's got a lot going on. Is there a key issue that stood out to you about Kubo and the Two Strings?
Yeah, weirdly, for all of the Eastern camouflage, it's set in ancient Japan and like you've got all these sort of traditional figures like samurai and things like that. What you actually have is a very Western theme going underneath it. And it's all about how do we keep our dead alive, okay? How do we stay with those people? Now, a Christian would say that's an easier concept than you understand. Somebody else has actually solved that for us. Eternity is in the hands of God, and that's where the people we love are going to be if they put their trust in Jesus. Whereas in this film, it wants to say something much more atheistic. The way you actually achieve eternal life for your loved ones is you keep them alive in your head, okay?
Like in your memories, you
mean? Memory is the most powerful magic of all. That's Kubo's line, you know, and so he realized I won't really give away the plot, but he solves his problem by drawing on the power of memory to keep the dead with him. And this sounds Eastern. It's not. It's really Western. It's this idea that there is no life after except for what we create in our heads with our family, you know, once they're gone. It's not terribly encouraging, even though Kubo is painted all smiles at the end of it. Honestly, this is not a patch on the eternity God provides.
Kubo and the Two Strings stars Charlize Theron, Matthew McConaughey, who we'll be talking about later in Free State of Jones, Rooney Mara, Ralph Fiennes, and Art Parkinson as the voice of Kubo. If you're an animation nut, you're in luck. It opened last Thursday at cinema, so go check it out. But do be careful if you're thinking of bringing the kids along, because Kubo is rated PG for mild themes and violence with some scenes that may scare young children. Mark, before we talked about Kubo.
Yeah, Matthew McConaughey seems to be all over the shop.
He does. And here he's back in our shop right now for True or False. And before we talked about Kubo, I posed this true or false statement. Tell me if it is true or false. When Matthew McConaughey first started getting famous in the late 90s, he asked his mum to be careful about what information she shared about him. She said, sure, I will do that, son. And then a week later, he's watching TV and his mum is leading a journalist around his old bedroom.
I'm going to say true, because my mother is like that. She'd offer, you know, a guided tour of our house to a perfect stranger with a camera because she's just lovely. So maybe Matthew McConaughey's mother is lovely. True.
Yes, mate, that's entirely true. I'm just amazed at your line of logic compared you and Matthew McConaughey in the same sentence and
I compared our mothers.
It's all about our mums. Yes, that is entirely true, that story of Matthew McConaughey.
I'm much more like Matt Damon than Matthew McConaughey.
And we will be talking about Free State of Jones much later on, as well as what else is coming up, Mark?
Oh, there's heaps coming up. Hang around for the rest of the show because we've got David Brent is back. Were you a fan of The Office? Well, you're going to actually have a chance to see him on the big screen in On the Road. Plus, we have an interview with Jesus. Rodrigo Santoro's from Ben-Hur is going to be joining us on the show.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Time for our soundtrack choice this week, Mark. And we're very soon going to be speaking about the new David Brent film, Life on the Road, which prompted me, Mark, to recall, a couple of years ago, I saw David Brent do a version of this very song. You might know it. If you don't know me by now, you will never, never, never know. That we've been through, you should understand me like I understand you. Now, girl, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to
to break up our happy home.
I can't even take the key change. Look, for those members of the audience we've actually just put to sleep, hey, wake up. Seriously, we're over that song. Why did you choose that one, Ben?
Mark, well, most people I'm sure would know, as you're just recalling now, that's a Simply Red version of If You Don't Know Me From Now from the late 80s, which was a US number one song. So a lot of people do actually like that song. It was originally recorded in the early 70s by a soul band, but then it's had various iterations. This one, most famously the Simply Red version, but Seal and Rod Stewart have done a version, as well as David Brent, the very famous character that Ricky Gervais created and performed in the original Office. We're very soon going to review the movie version of David Brent that's at cinemas at the moment. But if anyone has the box set of The Office, the British TV series, among the extras on that to do with the Christmas special, David Brent, who was a wannabe rock star, did this song. And it's meant to be a parody, but it's so close to being a homage, as in respectful. It's not that funny. So you get David Brent in cheesecloth and everything's white and soft focused, and he's in a bedroom and there's a lot of doves flying around for some reason. And even though he's indoors, there's a lot of wind. It's that kind of film clip. But David Brent, Ricky Gervais' version, isn't so far off this one, the Simply Red one, that really, I'm not really sure if it was a joke or he really liked the song.
I know. If we played the two of them parallel, trust me, you'd probably not be able to pick the two apart. Picture the worst boss you've ever had. Now, calm down. He's not in the room or anything right now. But chances are they're nowhere near the level of annoying and offensive as David Brent, the legendary character created and performed by British comedian Ricky Gervais in the original Office TV series. Well, it's been 13 years since we last saw paper merchant and wannabe entertainer David Brent. But he's back in his own movie, David Brent, Life on the Road. Ben found it to be a journey into mockery and self-assessment for the audience as much as for the breathtaking Brent.
Hello, I'm David Brent. You probably know me as the star of the documentary The Office. I'm currently a singer-songwriter.
Oh, yeah. Here they come. Come on in. We are foregone conclusion.
And a rep.
That's as stiff as you like and it won't damage your rug. Well, that's what I told her.
When I left Wernham Hog, I found myself again. And I started to do what I do best, entertain. Keep the noise down. Nah, turn it up.
Like, you're a big fan of The Office. How did you feel coming out of this film?
Mark, a little bit disappointed, I'd have to say. It has been 13 years since the British Office TV series was around. I don't know why Ricky Gervais needed to come back with David Brent on this occasion. None of the other cast members of The Office decided to, not a single one. And I think that says something about this movie. I'm not entirely sure exactly what, but it's...
He didn't want to share the royalties.
I think it says something. Interestingly enough, although I guess this does make some sense if you saw the original Office, David Brent, this character Ricky Gervais plays, basically the worst boss in the world, hasn't really learned anything in 13 years. He remains a walking, talking advertisement for the kinds of warnings against foolishness that you see in the Book of Proverbs. He's basically just a guy who, if you look at the Book of Proverbs and think, what does it say about fools? And then you look at this guy, he's basically it. So 13 years on, another disappointment about Life on the Road is that really it's the same storyline that happened in the Office Christmas specials. So for anyone who remembers those or hadn't seen them, here's a quick encapsulation. David Brent has left the paper company that he was the boss of in the original series. And now he's a traveling salesman, but he's also still a wannabe rock star. And so, like the Christmas specials here again, he's this wannabe celebrity. He wants to be famous. He wants to be liked. He wants to be known. And here in this one, Life on the Road, he basically plows all his money into going and doing a tiny tour of Middle England, playing his own original songs, which some of those are a bit funny, other ones not so much. And then for the rest of it, as you can imagine at The Office, it's really a repetition of the sort of comedy style and themes that you got in that show, which largely involve him being the most awkward person you've ever met, him saying terrible stuff and running his mouth over and over and over. You get a lot of the smutty sexual innuendo, a lot of the swearing in this, as you'd expect from David Brent. It's all still there, but why we needed to see it again, why we need to like catch up with this character. And I'm a fan of the show. I didn't have that answer for me.
So it's sounding a lot like the release of Absolutely Fabulous.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, your comments on that struck me as very, very similar. And you can go to the bigpicturewebsite.com to check out Mark's review on that. But that's right, as fans of original TV series that are making these late-breaking comebacks as movies, I'm with you. I'm scratching my head on this one.
Okay, but look, Dave Brent's always been a dreamer. Okay, he might be a fool, but he's basically a dreamer. Do we see any dreams fulfilled? Is there any hope for this guy, or are we just really in there to kick him?
No, it seems more to kick him. So he remains a dreamer, you're right. But it's always the dark side of the dream. That it's great to have goals and aspirations in life, but David Brent just refuses to listen to anyone's constructive criticism. Failure isn't an option for him, yet we constantly see him fail up on screen. And one of the issues I had with this movie is that in the TV series, and as much as it did set up us as an audience member to laugh at David Brent, there were so many characters around him that demonstrated that they understood him, they had some sympathy for him, they tried to work with him, they even kind of liked him. This one just seems like an out-and-out attack on this bloke to basically hold him up on a pedestal and tear him down about how ridiculous he is. There are so many side characters, because this is shot like a mockumentary, like The Office. Mm. So a lot of people talk to camera and tell us what we already know, that this guy is an insulting, offensive, deluded loser. Mm. And then, so what am I meant to do with that as an audience member? I'm like, And so yeah. I found it got really wearying, even though there are rays of light that show up in this around the dreams that David Brent has. And occasionally, he has moments of self-realization like he did in the TV series. However, when they do come, I found them largely unconvincing because of what had come before it. And you're not really given much from the David Brent side and also the people around him to suggest that this dreamer will ever learn much about who he is and his delusions. And so therefore, he really just remains an object of mockery.
Well, you've alluded a little bit to this, but I mean, what is it like as a viewer? I mean, in fact, what is it like as a Christian coming out of a film where you've basically been asked to laugh at somebody, not with them?
Mate, that's a really good question. And on this show, various times, we've talked about comedy and the different types of comedy that we like. And I do like this style of comedy. On the plus side, I think I like laughing at people's awkwardness and just when they get into difficult situations, how funny I can find that. Then you're right, the negative side is the mockery. And I think we can often focus on, if you're a Christian trying to live your life, you can think about what you say and what comes out of you and what you think about and then what you want to project. But how much thinking we do about what we take in, what we listen to, and therefore what we find funny about what other people say and what other people communicate. So one of my take homes from David Brent Life on the Road, because I don't have too much to recommend this, even to fans of The Office, I just don't think it's a necessary movie to go and watch. Sure, Ricky Gervais again plays David Brent and does it very well, but on the issue of mockery, I found I was digging further and further into my seat, questioning myself about why am I laughing along at basically what is a character assassination up on screen.
Train wreck.
And a train wreck happening before my eyes. It left me challenged, and I presume it will challenge other people too, about what is it that you laugh at and how glorifying to God is that?
It says a lot about ourselves, actually, what we choose to laugh at.
Yeah.
Well, David Brent, Life on the Road is rated MA 15+ for strong, coarse language. No surprise there, of which there's quite a lot, often of a sexual nature. Life on the Road is now showing at cinemas all over the shop and stars Ricky Gervais and no other cast members from the original Office TV series. Don't be looking for those repeat performances. Repeat, none of them are there.
No. Now, we want to hear from you. Come and tell us on Facebook. Go at The Big Picture Show. Find us at The Big Picture Show and tell us the kinds of things that you'd like to hear on The Big Picture. Maybe you've got an idea for a press record segment. Maybe you personally have a movie story or a movie theory or a TV tribute that you want to share with us here at The Big Picture. Contact us at The Big Picture Show. Let us know and you could possibly be joining our show.
How exciting for you.
I'll say.
Okay, well, still to come, we've got Rodrigo Santoro as Jesus. He'll be having a chat on the show with us. And of course, now in our now showing segment, Free State of Jones. Welcome back to the show. Well, it's time we talked with Jesus. In fact, actually, every time is time to talk with Jesus. But at least this time, it's a high time that Ben talked to Jesus. Ben was able recently to speak with Hollywood star Rodrigo Santoro, the actor who plays Jesus in epic remake Ben-Hur, which opened this week at cinemas. Santoro has starred opposite Will Smith, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Ewan McGregor. But as he tells Ben, taking on the Son of God was the most transformative and soul-shaking job of his career and his life.
Rodrigo Santoro, thanks very much for joining us on The Big Picture here in Australia. How are things?
Great, my friend. It's a pleasure. Everything's great. We're here working hard promoting our film Ben-Hur.
Mate, and you've been working hard playing Jesus. Now, on the list of roles an actor would most love and I would imagine fear to play, where's Jesus on that list?
On the top, for sure. That, you know, it's basically as big as it gets in terms of the, it's just bigger than life. It's not a character. It's not a part that you can compare to any other. You know, it's an experience that it transcends everything because it's just profound. And the idea of, you know, as an actor, what you try to do is you try to inhabit the character's body, his soul, his heart, and to have the opportunity to do that with Jesus Christ, it is an immeasurable gift to my own life. You know, it was just a completely, absolutely unique opportunity. And
you might even say bigger than Ben-Hur.
I would say so, because Ben-Hur, you know, it's a beautiful journey, you know, Ben-Hur's journey. But, I mean, Jesus carries so much, just the meanings and his teachings, and it is really, really deep. So, in a way, I have a hard time trying to compare to any other part, to any other role, to any other person. It transcended my expectations.
And you're an actor who's been in some big movies, Rodrigo, across your career, everything from Love Actually to 300, Focus with Will Smith and The Last Stand with Arnold Schwarzenegger. But we're talking about you playing Jesus in Ben-Hur. When you first got sent the script and got offered the role, was your first thought, no way, I'm just not going to do this?
Well, I had all kinds of mixed feelings and emotions at that time. It, you know, of course, at first there was fear, there was joy and happiness. I wanted to jump, I wanted to run, I didn't know what to do with myself. It was like, wow, this is crazy. How am I going to do this? Should I do this? Do I want to do this? And that was like when I first heard that I had the offer to play this part and in this film, which is actually not a remake. We're really trying to reimagine the story based on the same book. This is a very different version, and I would say much more aligned with the world we're living in today in every aspect, including the figure of Jesus in the film. The idea is to make him very relatable, you know, very just to humanize his figure as much as possible, to create, you know, this connection with the audiences. So it is, it's more of a direct connection. There's so many portrayals of Jesus throughout, you know, history, and it doesn't really matter how he looks like or how he speaks or how he should be. It is really about the essence and his teachings and about his love and heart. I was focused on trying to express that love. So somehow it was a process of rewriting a lot of stuff in my own life and my own, you know, experience as a human being.
Wow, Rodrigo, that's a massive role. It sounds like almost like a life-transforming role for you in your career. What do you then do to become Jesus on screen? Because Jesus is a bigger figure than he was in the 1959 version of Ben-Hur. But what do you do as an actor to sum up Jesus in a performance?
You search for the soul. You search for the heart. You search for the depth of the human. You try to understand. You try to access that place within yourself. There are different references in literature and gospels and the paintings and film and art in general. And I really try to dive as deep as possible to, if I could grasp, you know, a tiny understanding of Jesus' heart, it was already something huge for me. And I was trying to express that from a very human level. Of course, I'm not trying to be Jesus Christ. It's completely impossible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not searching perfection. I'm searching soul. I'm searching love and unconditional love, which was basically, you know, out of his teachings, it's probably the source of everything. And how is that? How is to practice that? My basic exercise was every day to try to practice genuinely to love unconditionally.
And whoa, that's big, Rodrigo. That's big.
Yeah, it is huge. And of course, that's actually not really possible being a human being, because we have all kinds of feelings, negative thoughts and emotions and everything that goes on, and we're like a roller coaster, because you can wake up in one way and then you driving and somebody, you know, there's a tailgater right behind you and you want to slam on the brakes and you have all this, you know, you are a human being. We are made of all that, but at the end of the day, we are born, and as soon as we are born, we come to this world. What we need is love. It's what makes us more than just bodies. So it is something that I was deeply interested in.
Rodrigo, when people go to see Ben-Hur, a lot of people will be going along for the massive spectacle, but Jesus is something of a heartbeat within Ben-Hur. So what do you expect audiences will take away from Jesus in this new reimagining of Ben-Hur?
Hopefully. people will feel him closer to them, and in a way that usually we see the figure of Jesus Christ and his presence in films and in any representation, and it's something that it's far away from you. It's something that you look and you say, wow, he was so divine and he was so perfect and I wish I could be like that. The idea here, which I think was the idea of the message, was we all supposed to be like that. So the way we found to make that more relatable was to ground him, humanize him very much.
Mark, it was great to get to have a chat with Rodrigo Santoro about being Jesus and Ben-Hur. As I mentioned earlier in the show, I also got to speak with Roma Downey, who is the producer of Ben-Hur, very, very famous producer. Her and her husband, Mark Burnett, were behind the Bible miniseries. So go to thebigpicturewebsite.com and check out that interview, as well as your review. You reviewed Ben-Hur on the show last week. That is up and running at the site. And speaking of websites and reviews and Ben-Hur, insights.uca.org.au. They're big supporters of our show. We love to get behind them as well. And Russ Matthews, a regular on our program here, has reviewed Ben-Hur and gives his own take on that as opposed to yours. So maybe you go and check out your review with Russ's alongside. And I'm not saying it's a competition, but you could always turn it into one.
I know better than to go up against the resident American.
Seriously. Now, one of the blessings of the cinematic world is that films can open our eyes to times and places we might have never come across otherwise. And they do so in a way that doesn't just widen our eyes, but opens our hearts. On Thursday, the American Civil War tale, Free State of Jones, opened at cinemas. And it tells the true story of a poor farmer who declares that killing to keep other people rich is no good reason to take up arms. Instead, he sets up a rebel territory in America's South, where all men are treated equally, and holds it against the might of the Confederate Army. But that's not the most surprising part of this story. Oscar winner Matthew McConaughey plays Newton Knight, a man who overturns governments, armies, and social expectations because the word of God comes before the word of man.
Mr. Moses, what are you?
Free man, Captain.
Why's that?
Because you cannot own a child of God.
No, you cannot, can you? You can own a horse, you can own a mule, or a cow, or an ox, but you cannot own a child of God.
That was a very pregnant pause at the end of that. Yeah. It is really a moving story, actually, and sort of lots of sort of thinking moments in it. It's set during the American Civil War, in particular Jones County, Mississippi, around 1862 to 1867. In fact, this is the most amazing thing about this story. True, true, true. Like, it's really well researched. It's really well presented. Poor soldiers conscripted into the Confederacy Army to fight for the rights of wealthy landowners and slave owners. And basically, they become incensed when they hear that they don't, you know, if you can own a certain number of Negroes, you can be exempted from fighting. So literally, the Civil War was, from the South's perspective, an army composed of poor people who couldn't pay enough to get out of fighting the North. Matthew McConaughey plays one of those fellows, a fellow called Newton Knight, who is a field medic who's incensed when his underage nephew is put in the front line and dies, and he decides this is just no way to live. He takes the child's body home to be buried. And when he gets home, he discovers that the countryside is being pillaged by who? The tax gatherers of the Confederacy Army. In the end, he runs off into the swamp because he can't take this anymore, finds a number of runaway black Americans, you know, who have been enslaved, and yet instead realizes there's a whole equality there. They're all suffering under the might of people's expectations of richer upper classes. And so he decides with them to start the Free State of Jones, a place where, based on biblical principle, they will live a life that actually values all human beings.
Mark, Oscars are a long way off. They're going to be handed out early next year. But are you willing at this point to say that this is another Oscar-winning performance from McConaughey?
Look, in so many different ways, this film is Oscar bait. Let's face it. Anything about the American Civil War, anything about slavery, does tend to pick
Academy
up.
Academy Awards love that kind
of
stuff, don't they?
Yeah, they do love
they?
That stuff.
Yes.
And in all honesty, though, He is brilliant. Matthew McConaughey is brilliant and believable as Newton Knight, this sort of stubborn take on the world character who doesn't just down tools in a fight for justice, but actually picks up arms, so to speak, to fight for what he believes in. You know, he's a character who changes his family's destiny for generations, and you can believe that. There's a really interesting subplot going on in the film that you cut to the 1960s every now and again to see what's happening to his family, his generations on, because of the stand that he made. It's an amazing film. You know, I really do like it. Did I make that point so far? I really like this film.
You did, and you made it to me before the show where I believe you said something along the lines of, this is one of the most Christian films you've seen in years.
You might think this is an interesting thing to say in the light of, say, the release of the remake of Ben-Hur,
yes,
which, as we a little earlier, we had Rodrigo Santoro on the show just talking about his role as Jesus. So there's a Christian take on film. You can put Jesus right center, or, and I think this is far more powerful, you can show how Jesus works out in people's lives, how a faith, you know, in the Lord actually makes a big difference. And
but are you saying, sorry to stop you, like, but, yeah, but is Free State of Jones a Christian film? Is it intending to be so?
No, and yet yes.
Right.
Okay. You see, it's not presented as a Christian story. It's presented as a man who lived a believable and faith-filled life, who did amazing things that you can all aspire to and value, and his motivation all the way through is clearly Christian.
Mm.
It doesn't hit you over the head with it. It doesn't have preachy moments, and is living, honestly, in a way, an admirable life. That recommends Christianity more than any other thing I could consider, and that in essence is why I think it's a great Christian film.
Do you think Free State of Jones has anything to offer in the world we're living in now, Christians all across the world? What's it got to offer to Christians today?
Yeah, I think that Free State of Jones should in some respects help us to breathe a bit of new life into an old phrase that I think, you know, like, I had a minister growing up who was a great guy, and he used to say this phrase to me all the time just as a young man going to school. He said, "Nail your colours to the mast." Now, people might not understand that old phrase, but it's the idea that if you're in a naval battle and you're going to go down the ship, or you're not going to change the allegiance of your ship, you send someone up the mast and you nail your flag, you know, to the mast.
You will not be moved on this.
You will not be moved on this issue. Newton Knight is a classic example of a man who's gone, but this is what I believe. And so he's nailed his Christian colours to the mast, and he is living out that faith, regardless of the cost to himself or to his neighbour's, you know, sensibilities, for that matter, to his family. He understands long-term, it's much better that they live in that world, a world that's coloured by God's ideals, than one which is more comfortable for them.
Mm, as we've said in the intro, living more by the word of God than by the word of man. Free State of Jones opened last Thursday, and I am now way more excited about seeing this than I was. It stars Matthew McConaughey, Kerry Russell, and Gugu Mbatha-Raw. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I threw that Gugu in, so I thought you'd love to have a go at it.
But it's not for the faint-hearted. Free State of Jones is rated MA15+ for strong themes and violence, but Mark, as he said throughout that entire review segment, it's well worth soldiering on into.
Well, we've got a few more things coming up yet that you should hang around for. Greg Clark's along to tell us whether or not actually resisting the state is a good idea for Christians. And of course, then the top five. This week, my top five mockumentaries.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Now, before the break, we talked a lot about Free State of Jones, a film about a Christian man whose convictions led him to disobey everything and everyone except his conscience. It got us thinking, do Christians have the right, even the responsibility, to set aside the law books if they run counter to the good book? Now, sure, we could answer that one, or we could call in Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark to do the heavy lifting on our behalf.
Romans 13, verses 7 and 8 tells us, "Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honour, then honour. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law." That's what the Bible teaches us. Well, I've broken the law of the land plenty of times. I've received speeding fines, parking fines, I've been late in paying my rates. I got fined for every one of those, and despite my passionately written pleas for leniency, I've had to cough up a fair bit of dough into the national coffers. But I've broken God's moral code far more frequently. I'm a liar, a cheat, immoral in ways you can't even imagine. Except that I know you can imagine them, because you are just like me. And like me, I hope you throw yourself on God's mercy and ask for forgiveness, because the Bible teaches that it is freely given by God to anyone who asks. There is a difference between breaking the moral code and breaking the law of the land. When we humans are doing really well, the moral code and the legal code come together rather nicely, but that's only true every now and then. Most of the time, we have to think carefully about the law and what it's trying to achieve. And Christians will always do this with one eye on whether the law brings about God's will, the things that God wants to see happen in the world. Well, the Bible, with its usual genius, explains this beautifully using the phrase, the law of love. Because as that verse from Romans tells us, if you're loving someone, you are in fact fulfilling the law. So this can be tricky. If the law says that you can abort a fetus, is it a loving thing to do? If it's not loving, you shouldn't do it. If the law says that you can build your side fence in a way that blocks your neighbour from reaching his garage, are you going to do the loving thing and build it back a bit, or keep to what the law allows you to do? First, ask the question, what should love look like in this situation? I'm sure that most of the time, obeying the law of the land is the most loving thing to do. And the Bible does tell us to submit to governing authorities because they are, quote, God's servants to bring about peace and fairness. But now and then, a Christian might really be challenged that to keep the law of love requires something different to what the law of the land requires. At that point, heaven help the person who puts human code before God's own heart. That's the time to love fiercely and tenderly and just take the consequences.
It's brilliant actually to have a chance to have a mind like Greg's on the show. And in fact, Greg is heading up Bible Society Australia, which is also by coincidence, happy coincidence, associated with Eternity Newspaper and Eternity Digital. So it's our chance to actually say thanks to the guys by pointing out that we've got some great articles you should have a look at, like this one, Why This Australian Actress Is Very Careful About the Roles She Chooses. It's an article about Anna McGann, who's been in TV shows and series, including Underbelly, House Husbands, and Anzac Girls and the Dr. Blake Mysteries, just to name a few. But being an actress is a hard slog, according to her, and sorting out what roles to say yes and no to is just one of the many things she struggles with. Well worth having a look at if you want to read more and get a Christian insight into the trials of acting. Find it at eternitynews.com.au. Oh, Ben, we've reached the highlight of the show. This is the point of the week I actually always look forward to, the top five. And this week in our top five, we've decided to be inspired by the David Brent mockumentary on Life on the Road. If you're not familiar with the term mockumentary, it describes a film that pretends it's a factual investigation in order to trip audiences up on the things they take for granted. So, you know, you might think a mockumentary that really caught the attention in 1999 was The Blair Witch Project. You know, the idea that
There's a remake of that coming out in September this year.
Yeah, how can you make a remake of something that was supposed to fool everybody?
I don't know. Sorry, I led you off the topic.
But
Blair Witch, yes, that was a mockumentary.
Other great things like Kenny, for example, the Australian mockumentary.
I'm taking it that's not actually going to be on your list.
These are not in my top five.
What the what?
Not in my top five also is one of my favourite mockumentaries, but I just couldn't squeeze it in, called The Old Negro Space Program.
What?
Came out in 2006.
That's an actual thing?
It's incredible. It's online. You should check it out. But look, I'm a documentary maker, and there's nothing I like more than a good laugh at my own industry. So to finish the show, I'm going to present you with my top five favourite mockumentaries.
Five.
Let me begin with the 2001 classic, R2-D2 Beneath the Dome.
Yes, I've never heard of that.
R2-D2
Beneath... And I thought I was a self-respecting film reviewer. I've never heard of this.
You've got to Google this. All these... it's a series of small documentaries detailing R2-D2's career.
I'm laughing already.
Prior to Star Wars, I know. From his English upbringing to his early dance career, his drinking problems, and his daring bungee jump, which is sort of like this moment of truth.
He had a dance career?
I know. This is my favourite moment. It's actually directed by Don Beese and Spencer Sussa. Anyway, Steven Spielberg is in this. There's a whole lot of big names.
Steven Spielberg actually turns up in this documentary.
And he talks about how George Lucas begged him for a part for his little buddy, you know, when he was really down in his luck post-Star Wars, in Saving Private Ryan. And so how Steven Spielberg was trying very hard to as a favour to George Lucas, to fit R2 into Saving Private Ryan. And you see this wonderful scene of R2 as a beach obstacle. You know, on the Normandy landing. It's a great moment in cinema.
Four.
Of course, you can move on to other great moments in cinema, great documentaries or mockumentaries in this case, and look at Best in Show from 2004. Now,
cracker.
This is a colourful array of characters who compete in the 125th annual Mayflower Kennel Club Dog Show. Basically, it's director Christopher Guest, who's familiar with mockumentaries will know that Christopher Guest is responsible for both starring in and producing some of the best mockumentaries out there. Well, he's one of the many weird characters who proliferate in this dog show extravaganza. The owner with two left feet, literally. The power couple who are flipping out over their prize-winning Weimaraner's psychological problems. You see a moment where a dog on a couch, that's priceless. The young collagen-injected model and the octogenarian who are apparently perfect for each other. I love that line. It's my favourite line in the film. We both love soup. So they're great moments.
It's funnier when you watch it.
Just the weirdness of watching people in those little, almost cult-like environments of making dogs look wonderful for shows. Three. But speaking of weird cult-like moments and insights into society, 2014's What We Do in the Shadows. It's basically a documentary team that lives with a group of vampires for a few months. And the vampires are in modern day society. They share a house in Wellington, of all places, in New Zealand.
Oh, this is that movie that's got something to do with the guys from Flight of the Conchords.
That's right. It's directed by Jermaine Clement. It talks about the domestic problems of being a vampire in Wellington.
Vampire in Wellington story.
It
yes.
It is hilarious. I mean, it's such an anecdote. Antidote to the whole Twilight saga. You know, it just where vampires look cool and have wonderful, expensive cars to drive around in. And here we are, these sort of down and out, sort of house share vampires in Wellington. My favourite moment.
How bloody and grim does it get?
It's a bit dark, but it's not scary dark. It's just kind of like, you know, like trying to feed on people but not get it over your best white frilly sort of cravats and things like that.
And do you have to be a fan of like serious vampire movies like Bram Stoker's Dracula or Nosferatu, or is it more directed at the Twilight crowd?
If you watch it and you are a fan of vampire films, and weirdly, I actually have made a bit of a study of vampire films.
Love Interview with a Vampire, that Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt movie.
I do. Look, weirdly, there's some interesting... One day we'll do my top five vampire films and I'll explain all why.
Okay.
But look, if you are a fan, you'll see all these little nods to all those sort of great films. But at the same time, what you really see is just how silly it is to imagine that we could actually be vampires and be quite comfortable in the 21st century. Two. But nothing comes close to 2003's A Mighty Wind.
Another Christopher Guest mockumentary.
Now, yes, again, directed by Christopher Guest. A Mighty Wind is this sort of ostensible reunion of all these 1960s folk bands for this great show at a town hall to memorialise a great promoter of folk music. And look, it sounds like a kind of a B-grade documentary, and it's pitched as that sort of like a B-grade documentary that might air late at night, but it is so funny. These couples who sort of get together who are still trying to keep alive their folk singing careers, you know, years on, and the changes in their lineups.
Given this is a list of mockumentaries, so in the title Mocking, which is usually about mocking the kind of format of documentaries and the seriousness of them, but in this case and in the other ones, I haven't heard you talk about whether you think we as audience members are meant to be mocking the people within the documentaries. And so in A Mighty Wind, do you think we're meant to be laughing at the fact these people haven't realized the dreams that they, or haven't kept on with the fame that they thought they had, or they're trying to live the dream but they're not really? Like, are we meant to be laughing at them or with them?
Well, I think it's not like the whole David Brent Life on the Road sort of situation where you're being tempted to laugh at the people. These people are definitely funny, but the ridiculous assuredness with which they put their opinions forward reminds you so much of the things we often confidently say ourselves. And, for example, our love of particular styles of music and how fantastic we feel that a particular, say, if you're a fan of rock and roll, you're a fan of punk, or you're a fan, and you can get really quite intense about it. But then when you see it in the context of people who are a real fan of American folk music, you realize how silly it can be to elevate some of these things, so you end up laughing a bit at yourself.
But that's not at number one.
No, no list of mockumentaries could be complete without 1984's This Is Spinal Tap.
Yeah, I didn't think you'd be able to get out of this list without having that movie at number one. I didn't want to ruin the surprise earlier, but I in no way am surprised that This Is Spinal Tap is at number one.
For those people who aren't aware of what we are so, you know, lovingly referring to, This Is Spinal Tap is a 1985 American rock music mockumentary. So this time we're kind of looking at a rock band as if we're following them around. In fact, it's actually directed and starring Rob. Directed by and starring Rob Reiner. It's got Christopher Guest in
it. The guy behind When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah.
And plenty of other movies. This is his only mockumentary, I think, though, Rob Reiner.
I actually don't know of any other that he's done. And this one, I think he's acted in a few films. And yet this one, actually, he comes across as a real earnest person who's trying to understand punk. You know, he's trying to understand heavy metal.
Yes.
And why this is such a big and popular thing. And the band, Spinal Tap, is really... In one sense, it's quite prescient because if you've seen Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, if you're a fan of some sort of music documentaries and you see how bands just explode sometimes when the camera puts on them, well, Spinal Tap was doing it as a comedy, you know, 20 years before that film came out.
And Christopher Guest, the director of Best in Show and A Mighty Wind, stars in this Spinal Tap, doesn't he?
He does. I mean, this guy's all over the shop. You know, Christopher Guest should just have a segment all of his own on our
show. Top five Christopher Guest movies.
Anyway, so... Basically, the film satirizes the wild personal behavior and musical pretensions of hard rock and heavy metal bands, as well as their crazy sort of documentaries of the time. You know, apparently, after the film opened, though, people didn't get the joke. Several people told Rob Reiner that they loved the film, but he should have chosen a more well-known band instead for his documentary. We have so venerated this particular film. We've even got it in the opening video clip to our show. Let me play you the segment that explains 11 as an important number.
This is a top to you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of 11, these and then amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes, you know, be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
Well, this is...
These go to 11.
<That's>, I know. Okay. Well, look, thanks very much for joining us this week. Coming up next week, the Big Daddy Show of the Year, our Happy Father's Day special.
In which will be appearing Mad Max and Lord of the Rings Aragorn, who are in new releases about very different parenting styles.
And Ben announces the top five movie dads he wishes were his dad, with no actual disrespect meant for his dad.
No disrespect, Dad. I still, next week, will be Ben McKechnie.
And I'll be Mark Hadley. I'll see you then.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.